Didn't know you'd be here. How come you missed the first couple nights? Where were you? Like you missed, you had a thing at a wedding? I suppose that's an excuse. Well, Steph. Well, listen, you missed out. Now, here's what we didn't do. We didn't talk about the incidents of the Great Tribulation. We didn't go over the various judgments and the bowls and the vials and how they equate. We didn't talk about the dried up river Euphrates and the 200 million man army that's going to come across. We didn't talk about the demons coming out of the pit and how horrific that's going to be and men seeking death and so on. We didn't talk about the judgment seat of Christ, which I think is going to happen while the world is going through that tribulation. We're going to be going up to glory, and then God's going to examine us at that time. And, by the way, the judgment seat of Christ is a time of rewards, not a time of punishment. Yet, there's language things that say, they shall suffer loss, and there's also language about, the wood, hay, and stubble being burned up. Every man's going to build on the foundation of Jesus and so on. It's not the judgment, the great white throne, it's the judgment seat of Christ. Different word for judgment. We can talk about that there. I think that judgment seat is going to be a time when God's going to prepare us in the tribulation to be serving Him in the kingdom with spiritual bodies. And I think we're going to learn at the judgment seat of Christ what service really counts and what doesn't count for the Lord. And we're going to heap up, God's going to pile up all the works, and then gold, silver, precious stone will be refined by fire. The good wood, hay, and stubble will go up. And I'm going to have a towering inferno there, you know, and it will be burned up and so on. But that'll get us ready for the kingdom. Now, here's what we did discuss, though. Tomorrow we're going to, will you be here tomorrow, Ben? Good. Tomorrow we're going to go over the Revelation 20. We're going to look at the kingdom. Right here. Why aren't you? Well, nobody else is paying attention. Man, the room's empty. After you got some singing, after you got singing, man, got them walked out. I'm preaching you. You're the one left in the room. That's a joke. He knows I'm joking. He knows I'm joking. It wasn't that big. tomorrow we're going to look at the Revelation 20. We're going to look at the millennial reign, and we're going to look at the great white throne and take a peek at the eternal state. And so that'll finish us up. Tonight, we're going to look at the characters of the end time rulers, the Gentile ruler and the Jewish ruler. But before we do, I'd like to rehearse a little bit what we've done. And so we defined what the term rapture is. So a lot of folks didn't know what rapture was before we started. So anybody here want to fill Bear in on what the rapture is? Because he missed that. Anybody? What's the rapture? Terrific, terrific. We get translated at that time, we receive our spiritual bodies, and we are eternal suits and ready to go. Now, you mentioned the Great Tribulation. Anybody want to explain to Bear, since he might have missed that, what the Great Tribulation is? Anybody? Someone else. How about a younger person? Anybody? Yes, no? I won't yell at you if you're wrong. No. Well, Bear, you just got to go through life wondering what the Great Tribulation was. Molly's looking. Well, talk amongst yourselves while Molly's looking it up. Okay. Also, we discussed the signs in Matthew 24. When Jesus talks about his disciples, says, what should be the sign of thy coming? And Jesus says it's a false Messiah. And we try to interpret that in Jewish terminology. What did it mean to the disciples? The false Messiahs meant false kings, false prophets, false priests. And we looked at the false kings, false prophets, false priests as people who entered into our time-space universe in around 1750 or so with new crazy ideas and isms that prepared the world for the end-time ruler. Religious systems that govern, that have a religion without revelation, a religion that's not based on the Bible, not based on authority. A priest that will not hear your confession but will absolve you of any responsibility and try to blame anything and anybody on the world. And no absolutes anymore. Nothing is definite. You can't be sure about anything. And then, of course, governments without God, governments that are not ordained, governments that are under no authority but their own. And so we looked at those new regimes and new regiments that are coming on the scene. Anti-Semitic government, and so on. Now we're looking tonight at the end time rulers. And I want the kids to do something for me here. When I was in Judaism, we used to have a holiday called Purim. Anybody ever hear of Purim? Yeah. Purim is a pretty festive occasion. It's almost like I don't want to say Jewish. Well, you know, you have this holiday at the end of this month where all kinds of horrific things happen and people pull pranks and so on. Well, Purim is kind of like a festive kind of time for pranks. You know, on the back table I have a prayer shawl there. You know, it has little strings on it, you know? And throughout the year, all of the Orthodox Jewish men will wear fringes on their garments. So the fringes will come down under their jacket. So, if I had a jacket on now, we have fringes on my prayer shawl, we know my shoulders. The jacket will be over my shoulders, and the fringes will be under my jacket, and the fringes would hang down. And at Purim, the rabbi is sitting on a chair like this. The stranger is sitting right here. On his jacket, you close his vision. And you can sneak up stealthy to the rabbi's chair and find his strength to you around the way you share. You see? Now, the rabbi gets up, of course, the chair follows him, goes and pulls down. It's really quite funny. And Purim is kind of like a festive occasion. You can do it and get away with it. Don't anybody ask me how I know you can get away with it. But now here's the deal. When we read in the book in Purim, we read where did Purim come from? Anybody know? What part of the book? Book of Esther. There, somebody else had their hand up first. That was rude. No, it was only Larry, so it doesn't matter. but comes from the Book of Esther, and you are really a sensitive person. I'm so sorry. But anyway, and what we do is we read through the Book of Esther, called the Megillah, the Megillah, and actually the Megillah includes other books, but they call the Megillah. And whenever Haman's name is mentioned, the young people would scream, "Boo!" Yes, and they make a lot of, they have a noise thing they hand out. And of course, when a Mordecai's name was mentioned, we'd all go, "Yay!" We clap and we cheer. Now, I'm wondering if we could try that, not with Larry and Bear, but as we go to Daniel chapter 7, as we come to a reference regarding the Antichrist, if you guys can go boo and hiss, and we have a mention of the Ancient of Days, the Lord Jesus Christ, if you guys can all cheer. You think that'll work?
Great.
Yeah, we're going to go for it. Okay. So, let's start at, verse 9. Let's go back to verse 8, okay? I consider, let's go back over here. How about, I'll go back to, I don't know where we are. Daniel chapter 7. I haven't started yet, apparently. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 6. Okay? After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings, the fowl, the beast falls on its forehead, and dominion were given to it. As it is, I saw in a night vision, behold, a fourth beast. We're a little slow on that fourth beast thing. I think some of the fourth and Red Sox fans here don't know how to cheer or how to move. Dreadful and terrible and strong exceeding, and a great iron teeth to devour and break in pieces, stamp the residue at the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. There you go. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. There you go. Before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, there was born with eyes as the eyes of man, and the mouth speaking a great thing. And I beheld from the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days. Alright, okay, now we got it. Whose garments were white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His stone was like a fiery flame, and his wheels of burning fire. A fiery stream issued, came forth from before him. Thousands and thousands bid it not to him. He should be still cheering. And 10,000 The judgment was set, and the books were opened. And I beheld them because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. Now you got it. I beheld thee until the beast was slain. There we go. And by destroyed and given to the burning flame. Okay. And I saw the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man. And the clouds of heaven, it came to the Ancient of Days, and brought him.
Daniel had a vision in Daniel chapter 2. We saw the image of the beast that Antiochus had. And that actually predicts the next four Gentile empires. And out of the fourth empire, we have one that's unique or different from the others. And so the Roman Empire was different. It was more mighty. It was different in expanse, different in power, different in government than the others. And out of this revived Roman Empire, we're going to see the revival of the end-time ruler. I hesitate to call him Antichrist. And I'll tell you why, because when we think of Antichrist, we think of somebody who's in opposition to the Messiah, and we think of false Messiah. And the false Messiah is a Jewish man, and this end-time ruler is a Gentile man. The Jews would never accept a Gentile Messiah. So we're looking for two different beasts. And the first of them, who's the least, who's not quite as powerful, not kind of impressive, is going to be the forerunner for the other one. And the more important one is the Gentile ruler, the end-time world ruler. And the less important one, who has the same power of that beast, is called the false prophet. Let me just look at some scripture here. Daniel 7, verse 7 describes this fourth beast. He's dreadful, he's terrible, he's extremely strong. He was different from all of the other empires, and mentions the 10 horns and so on. Daniel 2, verses 40 to 43, verse from this verse as well. Verse 8, another comes up from them. There were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Well, some kind of military takeover is described there. And I don't know how that all fits together. But there's some kind of military takeover, and the way he comes into power is described in a lot of detail with the seven heads and so on. And I think it's because that he's going to come on with such popularity and such overwhelming success and acceptance that the descriptions of him have to be very, very precise so that people will know that guy is wicked. Hard to believe that a person that wicked is going to be that popular and that accepted. I think now
Some of you didn't quite get it this morning, but let me clarify it. That in Ezekiel 38, it's my belief that the Islamic nations are going to come against Israel. And they're going to do so because of Israel's attack or preemptive strike on the nation of Syria. Israel is going to destroy the city of Damascus. That we know from Isaiah chapter 17 and Daniel and Jeremiah 49. There's no doubt that Israel destroys Damascus. That's a fact. And it seems from Isaiah chapter 17 that because Israel destroyed Damascus, there's a war against Israel. That's a fact. Now, when and where it's going to happen, I don't know. And if that war is Ezekiel 38 or if that, we can't be sure. But it looks to me, this is the word spoil in Isaiah chapter 17 and repeated in Ezekiel 38, that the Ezekiel 38 war is the war that comes from the destruction of Damascus. Israel destroys Damascus, and as a result of that, the Islamic nations come against Israel. Islam is destroyed in the mountains of Israel. Every Islamic person still knows, but the rulers and the leaders and the predominant power of Islam will be wiped out. Now, Islam, let me talk about this. Islam cannot exist in the mutual exchange and a fair exchange of ideas. It cannot. It is a religion that is totally untenable. The only reason Islam is successful is because they have a wonderful method of evangelism. It's convert or die. You know? And they have a wonderful discipleship program. Ask questions and you're killed. So people convert to Islam and they don't question their religion. They just go through the motions. But as I mentioned to you, if you look at Islam, their cosmology or their worldview is that the world lives on the back of a turtle. And as a turtle moves through the world, that's what caused the winds and tides and the waves and so on before. Now, I think that if you get a telescope out, you'll be able to see without too much difficulty that there's something wrong with the Quran. The Quran is not accurate. It's not accurate geographically, scientifically, biologically, historically. It makes no prophetic word whatsoever. The few times it quotes the scriptures, it quotes it inaccurately. It is totally unreliable. It makes no sense. Now, I'll just give you an example. The Quran was written about the 6th century of the Common Era. The Torah of Moses was written almost 2,000 years earlier. Which one do you think would be more scientifically accurate? That which was written 2,000 years earlier, or that which was written all 2,000 years later, when it had all those years of science to base itself on, and all of man's observations? Which one has the world on the back of a turtle, and which one has in the world hung in a sphere as a circle? Which one talks about gravity? Which one talks about the hydrology? Which one has a knowledge of biology, the life of the flesh is in the blood, and so on and so forth? The Bible has wisdom from on high. The Quran has ignorance from on low. You know? And there's no doubt, you can't compare the two. You get, and one of them totally is unacceptable. It's totally spurious. And the other is obviously revelation from God by comparison and contrast. No, Islam would never live in a fair exchange of ideas. If you destroy the military, you destroy the religion. There may be a few people hanging on to it, but as a culture, and once the military is taken, the meat's taken out of it, in the Ezekiel 38 war, there'll be no more, they'll have no more influence on the world. And that will leave the world empty, void, without great power. And remember, every time you remove a leader, what do you get? Another leader. What are you going to get this time? You're going to get, I believe, the end time leader that we see in Daniel chapter 7, and so on. Now, Daniel 7:23, please don't boo. Thus he says, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all the other kingdoms. The vision is described now. He shall devour the whole earth and shall shred it down and break it in pieces. So you see the universal world leader. Now, even in that, we see, and it's rather interesting, the 10 horns of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse in his person, and he shall subdue 3 kings. So we see some kind of universal dominion, and then we see skirmishes within his dominion, and it's hard to really put it all together about how those 3 kings are defeated, but they are. And look at verse 25. He shall speak great words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints. This speaking. Look at verse 8:23. And the last times of their kingdom, when the transgressors come, a king of fierce countenance and unseeing dark sentences, so stand up. The unseeing dark sentences isn't referring to incantations, although it sounds like that. But nothing in Hebrew and nothing in the Macedonian passage indicate that there are incantations and chants. I don't think it's witchcraft. I just think that men love darkness rather than light because of deeds or evil. And this man's going to have an uncanny ability to sway the crowds with his uncanny speech. If you just notice that those false prophets and false priests and false kings that have been on the earth, how much of a control that they've had over our society and civilization, especially when it comes to blasphemy and the acceptance of blasphemy and of the ridicule of evangelical Christians. It's kind of an amazing thing that that there was a mutual respect a long time ago that has totally disappeared from our civilization. You can run almost, if you say something ill of any religion or of any race or any ethnic group and you want not to, it's unacceptable in our society. But if you talk about a Christian in inappropriate terminology, it's almost popularized in our society. It's accepted. The few times I get a chance to watch a comedian or one of these guys on television, Christianity is open game. It's always the season is open to take shots at the evangelical. And it's amazing how a world has come to that position and that conclusion. It's always fun to take pulse and to poke fun at the leaders of the Christian world. That's the way it's been. I shared a book it wasn't too many months ago that I was cashing a check in the bank. And the check was from Friends of Israel, my expense check, and the girl at the counter, the teller, says, Friends of Israel. And she seemed to be upbeat about that. Well, I thought she was upbeat about that. I thought she was an evangelical Christian. And so I immediately jumped into my testimony. I mentioned in the book how isn't it easy to share your faith when you think you're going to be well accepted. You know, when you think you're dealing with a Christian, you say, oh, let me tell you about my faith. And boy, was I surprised. She was not a Christian at all. And she was very, very vocal about her anti-Christian belief. And she called Jesus a coward. She attacked him. She attacked his character. And she had all kinds of misunderstanding about him. And I was really shocked because, if I was going to think of a non-offensive people group, it would be bank tellers. You know, they are always trying so hard to make people feel kind of you. Can I help you? Do you want to balance with that? And they're always so nice. And this woman just laced into my face and I couldn't believe it. And I said, somebody, she should get fired for that or be rebuked for that. And everybody was looking over like, yeah, give it to them, you know? Yeah, all right. So what is this work? What is going on here? You know, and what's going on here is they hate Christians. That's what's going on here. and the meek and the mild and the docile, and they're ready for us to go, you see. And look, this guy, he just wears the saints out. He just wears the saints out, and his black, belching, dark, ugly rhetoric makes him popular. Makes him popular. People want to hear that. Nobody here, maybe. Turn to Daniel chapter 11. Verses 13 through 19, we're talking about a man named Antiochus the Great. And that means very little to you, but after the Babylonian and Persian, after the Persian Empire, you had the Greek, the Neo-Persian Greeks. After Alexander the Great falls off the scene, his empire falls to four different generals, and the two that we're most concerned with are the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Up in Syria, and Syria you had the kings of the north, and then you had in Egypt, you had the kings of the south. And Daniel 11 describes the various wars and marriages and intermarriages to make for peace between the two kingdoms in such great detail that most of the people who read Daniel 11 years later looked at that, you know what? Daniel 11 is a prophecy, but it's history. We have textual evidence that places the book of Daniel into antiquity. But many people read it and say, can't be, because it's so uncanny in its specificity. Now, verses, 13 through 19, refer to a guy named Antiochus the Great. And then 21 and following, we see the rise of a man called Antiochus Epiphanes. And each of these kings of the north are typical of the end-time world ruler. And from verses 22 and following, somewhere in there, verse 35 certainly, we begin talking about the end-time ruler only. So all of these verses kind of gives a glimpse of the kind of person that's going to be accepted by the world, elected if he was voted on, but he's going to come in through other means. But yet the world is not going to have a problem accepting him. King of the North shall return, shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years, with a great army and with much riches. And those times when many stand up against the king of the south, and also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fail. Fall. The king of the north shall come up and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against them shall do according to his own will. Watch this. We have a willful king. None shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now, just like the Antichrist, just like Antiochus Epiphanes who follows him, this king does a few things. One is he's very, very willful, self-willed. One, he will go into the land of Israel, and he will attempt to consume or destroy the land of Israel. He also set up a state to enter with the strength of the whole kingdom, and upright ones with him, thus shall he do. He shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but shall not stand on the side, neither before him. After this, he shall set up the isles, take many, but a prince of his own shall cause the reproach offered to him to cease, and with his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Moves verse 21. In his stead, shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom.
Antiochus Epiphanes, what happened was he went down to Egypt, the first time. He comes out of Egypt, and you all know the story. It's probably legendary right now, where he goes to Egypt and he
to conquer, but he's really not really much of a military kind of guy. And Rome was coming on steam in power, and the early Roman leaders would have to be holding him like a chick for protection. And the Roman embarrassed him terribly. They're throwing a circle now. Remember this? And so if you want to stay in Egypt, stay in the circle. If you say that, he crossed the line, and he wouldn't, and turned tail and ran. But when he ran, he went back to Israel, and he was very, very greatly embarrassed by the fact that his soldiers saw him turn coward, so he decided to display his military prowess by beating up the Jews, and this is when he destroyed the sanctuary, put up the abomination decoration of pig and so on, and all of the things. When he comes back into Syria, while he was gone, his brother had already heard about his embarrassment, so his brother declared himself as king. That would have been devastating enough for Antiochus, but what luckily happened is so that about 40 other people could get so king. So instead of having to conquer anybody, he comes back in peaceably, and then he steals the kingdom through flattery and lies. What he did was he took the spoil of the bounty that he ripped off the Jewish people and paid Rome the tribute that was overdue. And paying Rome tribute, no Rome support them. And then through flattering lies, by making deals with other people, he got support and he comes into the kingdom peaceably, but he never was honored like a king. This is a guy who he played the saxophone on Saturday Night Live. And I don't know how to describe it any better. He was just a people kind of guy, and everybody kind of respected him, not as one of being like royal, they respected him as being like, he's our guy, he's one of us. And he didn't have the honor of the kingdom, but he has the heart of the people. He used to hang out in the bars and sing songs, and that's true. That's what kind of man he was. So, verse 21 following, he is saved from sin of a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flattery. And the arms of a flood shall they be from beforehand, and he shall be broken, yea, also the friends of the covenant. And after that, the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, he shall come up, and shall come strong with the small people. He enters peacefully, even unto the fattest place of promises, he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. He shall scatter among the prey, and spoil, and riches, yet he shall fork his right among the strongholds, be for a time. But it says, he's going to open up the storehouse that belonged to the royalty and give it to the common folks and buy their allegiance, which is a new kind of leader. He maintains his rule government and can control over them by giving things over to them. Let me look at the flattery again. Look at verse 37, both these kings' hearts shall do mischief, they shall speak lies at one table, but shall not cross the end to be at the time appointed. Look at verse 35. Verse 35 of Daniel 11 is almost unreadable. I have to go to page 438 to translate some of these things. Let me read from my book. Daniel 11:35, at some time the understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because of these entities the time appointed. What does that mean? Anybody have a better translation? I put down CF 138 because I have to translate it myself. Forgive me for this, but I write here, I just love the King James Bible. I don't think it's based on a superior text. I don't think it's the most accurate translation. The reason I love it is for verses like 11:35 in Daniel. See, a verse like that just has to be explained. It's so very obscure that it requires a teacher and it keeps me employed. I should have read, it should be something like this. Some of those who have understanding will fall into persecution. Through this persecution they will be refined and cleansed and made pure until the time of the end, for the appointed time is yet to come. And speaking about the Maccabee situation where Hanukkah was developed, and we see from that time forward, the appointed time of the end, we see now we shift to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes, and start talking about the end time when ruler. Verse 36, and the king shall do according to his will, he exalts himself and magnifies himself above every god, that would be like 2 Thessalonians 2, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall regard the God of his fathers. Let me stop and think here for a second. If you think neither they're not regarding the God of his fathers, you might be thinking some kind of Jewish person referring to the God of his fathers. But if he's a Catholic Pope, then the God of his fathers would also be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I think that this is what exactly we see here, that this man is going to be some kind of end-time world ruler. I think he's going to be a religious man, and I think that he's going to come into power because he's going to claim peace and prosperity, and the world is going to accept him, and I think he's going to set up a one-world religion. And so he doesn't regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women. Now, there's no desire of women. I heard somebody say he has to be a homosexual. He doesn't have the desire of women. The desire of women there simply means that he doesn't have any regard for the Messiah. The desire of women in Jewish thinking is to be the mother of the Messiah, and the desire of women is the Messiah, and he has no regard for the God of his fathers, nor for the Lord Jesus Christ either. That's what that is saying. Or regard for any God, for he magnifies himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. And a God whom his fathers knew not. Now who is the God of forces? The God of forces is the prince of power of the air, the God of this world. And to that God he gives honor. And, honor that God with silver and with gold and with precious stones and pleasant things. Let's turn to, Revelation chapter 13. John has this vision, and he sees it stands upon the sand of the sea, and he saw a beast rise up out of the sea. The beast has 7 heads, 10 horns, and 20 horns, 10 crowns, and 20 heads of the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, feet of a bear, nothing personal, mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him power and his feet and great authority. So we see the leopard, the bear, and the lion. You go back to Daniel chapter 2, and you realize you're talking about he's a conglomeration of the Gentile empires that reigned over the Middle East, the time of Daniel forward, leading up to the Roman Empire, and he's like the fourth beast, which is a revision somehow of the old Roman Empire. And he's a Roman. After that, they worshiped the dragon, she powerless to be hooked. And I saw one of the heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Now, the deadly wound being healed, it's hard to know exactly what that's referring to. It could be that some are saying it's a reference to the resurrection of the old Roman Empire, which was dead and now revived. But I don't think so. I think there's some kind of miraculous quasi-resurrection here, that somehow he's wounded, either in battle or assassined or something of that nature, and deadly wound was healed. whether he's risen from the dead or whether he was just almost dead or near dead or in a comatose state or what, apparently is some kind of unusual, supernatural kind of thing that causes everybody to wonder after the beast. And they worship the dragon, which is the devil, which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, who is able to make war with him? There was given unto him a mouth speaking, here we go again, speaking great things, blasphemy. Power was given unto him to continue for 42 months. And here we go again. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and then the throne in heaven. And was given to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given them over all kindreds, tongues, and nations. And all they that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life. We'll look at the Lamb, and we'll see that tomorrow morning. We'll screen those books, from flames of the foundation world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. And he that leads the captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So this first beast, has he worked any miracles?
No.
Has he done any miraculous things? What has he done to gain the favor and the wonder and the worship of the world? I don't see him threatening anybody. What's the one thing that he's been doing from Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 11, and Revelation chapter 13? What's he do? Speaks. He's a speaker. That's the way that he speakifies. He orates. He preaches. He teaches. He runs around campaigning. He wins the favor of the world through his use of the dark words. He blasphemes God. He blasphemes the faith. He blames God for the power of the world. And everybody loves to hear somebody being blamed for everything, and they all just follow after him because of his speaking. And it's a marvelous thing to see the power he has just by belching out his message. Now, where does this beast come from? John stood at the, and he saw a beast coming from where? Where did it come from? The 13-1. Came from where, anybody? Came to the seashore. And, if you know the way Jewish people think about things, when they're in the land of Israel, and you see the Mediterranean Sea, the sea represents the Gentiles. Sea represents the Gentiles. And so, this beast comes up out of the sea, he's a Gentile world ruler, probably, maybe a Pope, papal figure of some kind, comes into power after the Islamic religion has been destroyed, and there's a tremendous emptiness in the Middle East, people looking for authority, looking for control. This guy is going to promise them peace and safety. He's going to make a deal with the Jews, set up a one-world religion, and sign a contract with the Jewish people. Remember, the people of the prince in Daniel 9 that shall come will destroy the city of the sanctuary. The city of the sanctuary is destroyed by the Roman people, and so the priest that shall come will be a Roman person, a Roman prince. Now, by Roman, it could possibly refer to European, it could possibly refer to Roman Catholic, it could possibly refer to Italian, but I'll tell you what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean Jew. Okay? So we know he's not a Jew. He's a Gentile ruler of some kind. And this Roman ruler, perhaps the leader of the Catholic Church, I can't be sure of all of that, but he's not a Jew. And his great speakifier is going to gain the entire world, every nation, country, to worship him on the basis of the ability to blaspheme. Now we have another beast that comes out of the, where? Verse 11. Where does he come from? Earth. When you hear the word earth, you think of Eretz, land, Israel. Eretz Israel. In contrast to city, you see Eretz Israel, you see this guy comes from the land. And look, he had two horns like a lamb. Well, you gotta think of Judah and Ephraim. You gotta think this guy is a Jew. Say he represents the nation of Israel. Now this Jewish guy, he spake as a dragon. He exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and he causes the earth. Now, the world, the Gentile world, already worships the beast. The kindred nations, tongues of the Gentiles worship the beast. But Israel didn't. And he's going to cause his fellow Jews to worship the beast. See it? He's not, the kindred nations, tongues, all that trouble, they already worshiped him. But this guy is going after the Jews. And he's a false prophet that will get the Jews to worship the beast. Now, how does he do it? You see, he's going to exercise all the power to first beast, causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And how does he do it? He deals with wonders that he make fire to come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. You see, you remember what Corinthians said? The Gentiles, the Greeks, they want what? What do they require? Wisdom. What do the Jews require? A sign. So how does the first beast win the world? Through eloquent speech. And wisdom wins the Gentile world. How do the Jews come around? They see his miraculous sign, calls out fire from heaven. And they see all these powerful miraculous things, and wow! And they start following the false prophet. And the false prophet is going to direct them to worship the Gentile ruler. See how that works? In Brooklyn today, there's a Lubavitcher Chassidim Center. Means nothing to you, I suppose. But, they have had seven descending rabbis from a man called the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov is the master of the good name. His name is Israel Ben Eliezer. He lived in 1600 Poland. And he started a modern charismatic Jewish charismatic movement. Have you ever seen Fiddle on the Roof? You ever hear the song, If I Were a Rich Man, all day long I'd what? I'd bitty, 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 bitty bum. You know what that is? That's Hebrew tongue. It really is. I'm kidding you. I've been there. I've seen them. I've heard them praising and worshiping God in static utterance. And it wasn't Hebrew. It wasn't Yiddish. And it wasn't English, and it was bitty, bitty, bitty. I could see them say them, that's what it was. It's just ecstatic utterance, and they get all excited, and it's really great. And are you asking a question? Cool. What's that? About the what?
Movie.
Movie, Fiddler.
Yes. What kind of a person was the main character when you were a Christian?
No. Tavia was Jewish. Jewish man, yeah. You know a blessing for the Tsar? Yeah, especially for the blessing for the Tsar.
Oh, I know.
What's the blessing for the Tsar?
One
point
of the Tsar is that
keep
them far away from us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. May the Lord bless and keep the Tsar far away from us. Isn't that special? I love that. Yeah, my kids pray bless me like that too. I'm not sure, but anyway, I have a brook for everything. I have a brook for everything. Anyway, the seventh son This guy who starts this movement called the Chassidim. Ha is the Tzadikim is righteous one. Righteous one. The other Jews are mocking them by calling the home goals, the pious ones. And they took that term of making fun of them, and they made a term of endearment. And now we have a group called the Lubavitcher Chassidim. Lubavitcher refers to the city which they started, and they have the altar ready, and then proceeding on down. The last descendant was a man named Menachem Schneerson. Menachem Schneerson was from the tribe of Judah, and he let everybody know that the first 20 years of his life he didn't have any ministry. From 40 to 80 he was like the prophet Moses, and then from 80 to 120 he was going to declare himself to be a Messiah, but unfortunately he died. And when Menachem Schneerson, I think in 1994 or so, like 3 or 4 years before he died, they would come into the room and they would sing songs of King, Redeemer, Messiah. And every time they came to the room, they started singing the song. And he just and he didn't stop. Then he had a stroke. And he couldn't move. And he was stuck in a wheelchair. And when they started singing the song, he started to shake. And he said, hey, he started to sing louder. And they actually believed him to be the Messiah. When he died, no other rabbi has taken his place. He's still functioning as the rabbi. And, I don't think he's the prophet with any healing that, but they believe him to be their Messiah. You can go there, we'll take a trip. I took Danny and Priscilla and some of the other guys from camp here, Steve Whitaker and others, and we went there, and we had to show a big battle with his picture on it, a king, redeemer, Messiah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they got billboards on the store in that little section of Brooklyn and in Israel. There's other sections that they still respect him as a Messiah. And they're looking, I don't know, for his eternal life. Rabbi Schneerson wrote an extensive amount of letters. He wrote a tremendous amount of letters. He was a prolific writer. And they took all of his letters that they find and just haphazardly put them into books. And whenever somebody comes to with a problem or a question, they take their problem question and they open up the book and they throw the letter in. Then they open up the letter and lo and behold, every single time your questions are resolved and by that particular page that was found by the letter. Some of that's arbitrary, but hey, be a little faith, you know? And they say that's increased his ministry. Because before he had to have an audience with people and only see 10 or 12 people a day. Now, there's no telling how he can just scroll out of it all day long. Now he can just do 1,004. So now that he's doing more than he was before he was alive. And so, you people have no little faith, you know? So, put your letters in the back table, I'll take them to Brooklyn for me, I just want to share, this is what the Jewish people believe. The Roman Orthodox really believe that Schneerson is their Messiah. Now, you show them a few signs. Have somebody call down fire from heaven, and I want you to know that it's very easy for them to be led into following this Messiah. The tragedy is that there's an empty tomb in a ruined temple, and they won't come to believe in the real Messiah. So anyway, he does great wonders, so he made fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of man. And you see this thing that's all on the earth by means of those miracles. Now, earlier I had referred to the resurrection or the perhaps resurrection of the Antichrist, misnomer, the end time ruler, as a miracle. And some of you guys got a little upset because I used the word miracle. I didn't stop and correct myself, I just went on. And now I just want to go back and show you that are these things that are happening good things? Are these happening from a good source? But yes, but it's called, what's the Bible called? If you saw a miracle, we just tend to say that if a fake, you know, it's not a miracle. If God says it is a miracle, but biblical language, any supernatural thing is a miracle. And a miracle can have a very short intent. That's why we gotta believe the book. and not necessarily the miraculous things that we see. So if somebody's doing miracles, that don't mean it's right. Make them wrong, but that doesn't make them powerful. And who has power to do in their sight of the beast, they can as well on the earth that they should make an image of the beast. Look at this. They make an image of the beast which has the wound by a sword and wind. And they have power to give life as the image of the beast. Can you imagine that? How evil it is?
They're going to,
I'm giving you a choice right now. You want to let anybody live stuff right to God, that's good, but you got to stop being this guy. I'm not talking about dating. I'm talking about stuff that she just shouldn't have been involved in. And she said, I'm not ready. He loves me. So I said, that's fine. I'm not going to baptize you. You know, that's my prerogative, isn't it? So I just choose to baptize mom. About 3 weeks later, the daughter saw the light and dumped the jerk. And now she calls me up. She wants to get baptized. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm too busy now. I don't come out with one. You want me to baptize you? Maybe two more people did. I was joking. I was joking. She went and the two girls to the Lord. I should have held out the fire. So now I come out, baptize the three of them. But now it's getting cold. It's like October, September now, and the weather wasn't like it was back in July when I wanted to do the first baptism. And so, and there's an unsaved Jewish guy named Ted. And it was really kind of cute because we got there in the morning on Saturday at like 10 o'clock and we were going to the bathroom, but it was really cold and raw and windy and it was drizzling outside. So we said, well, wait a while. And so we sang some hymns and we did some Bible study and we waited after that 12:31 o'clock. And Ted was wired up for 2.5 hours. Oh yeah, then the God, all right, sure. You don't think he can give you a nice day for a baptism, do you? I guess maybe you're not crying louder. Maybe you got to sleep. No, he just went on and on and on. And ridicule us about the weather conditions built in the baptism stuff. And we try to be like, look, the waves all the time, and it's not, you know, nothing really needed. There's no God, you know, the weather's bad. And he just put us through it. Well, at 12:31 o'clock, we said we're going to go out there and do the service. And we opened up the screen door, and all of a sudden, clouds started, the sun came out, and it dried up. And it got 10, 12 degrees warmer, and it was really about the night. So we got into the pool, the girl gave you a testimony, we baptized them with the glory of God, we had a couple songs, we came back in, and the screen door closed, you heard a roll of thunder, a clap of lightning, and the both cloud birds and sort of rainy day. I mean, as the screen was closed, and we all looked at Ted. And Ted said, oh, it's just a coincidence. It stops raining here in the church all the time. And I said, well, it was no miracle. I'm willing to admit that God didn't supernaturally change the order of the time-space universe, but it was extraordinary providence. And when we stepped out by faith, we got warm weather, and when we were done, there was no need for him to hold back the ring, and we came in. And I said, Ted, I want you to remember how much you harassed us, because I think God is speaking to you. That if we continue to drizzle all day long, it wouldn't change my life. But I think that was just for you. You'll be thankful that God cared enough about your unbelieving heart to listen to you and to respond in kind. You ought to pay attention. And Ted, if in a couple years you do get saved, I trust it rains something terrible the day you get baptized. And you know, God gave me that wonderful privilege of baptizing Ted in the middle of a downpour. 2 years later, it just wouldn't stop raining. And Ted and I laughed and laughed and laughed as everybody hid behind the windows watching you baptize into the pool with the thunder and the lightning and the storm. And there are miraculous things out there. There's some scary stuff out there. There's a real God. And remember, God will hold no good thing from you. Remember, there I try to tell him over and over and over again. I try to tell him that if he spared not his own son, but delivered us all, won't be with us freely, give us all things. I told him I have not seen or entered in the heart of man what God has reserved for them that love him. I told him that every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of light, with whom there's no burial, the shadow of turning. And I told told that we have to think about those who are just, pure love, and focus our attention on those things, and they are expressed known to God, the peace of God will keep our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. The answer is that nothing. God is in control. And we see putting hopes and joys in nations. Whatever's going on in the Middle East, don't worry about it. My Heavenly Father, your Heavenly Father, the one who gave Jesus for me and for thee, is in control of it all. And so, keep looking up. Our redemption is yours.